Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to tell a true story through melody and lyrics, and how does that creative presentation affect the way an audience relates to history? The opera With Blood With Ink tells the story of Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz, a 17th century nun who lived in colonial Mexico and is considered one of the most important intellectual and literary voices of the New World in her era, but later was forced by the Inquisition to renounce her scholarship. Daniel Crozier is composer, and Peter M. Krask is librettist of the opera, which will have its main stage premiere as part of the Fort Worth Opera's Opera Unbound series in April. Guys, welcome to Think.
Hi.
Happy to be here.
So I was tempted to call this a new opera in my introduction, but I know that the history of this work has been far more complicated than that. This has been around and sort of part of your lives and your souls for 20 years now.
20 years, yeah, hard to believe.
Yeah, it's the 20-year anniversary, actually.
How did you initially come together to work on this?
We met actually in graduate school at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And I had approached the opera director, Roger Brignate, about a different opera project that I had worked on. And he had suggested working on a new piece and said, I think you should work with Dan Crozier. And at the time, we thought it would be like a 20-minute piece that would maybe get a little workshop. Basically, they needed something for the extra sopranos to do at the school. And then as Dan can finish up, it turned into something much bigger.
Yeah, Roger Brignate had actually written the libretto for my first full-length opera, a one-act opera called The Reunion. And that was a very positive experience for both of us. And Peter, in the meantime, had approached him. And Peter sent me a draft, and I was still interested in opera very much, and I said, well, I'll read this. But I thought it's an outside chance, you know, to really make that connection and say, yes, this is something I want to do is quite rare. So I read his 20-page draft, and it was the summertime, and I was taken with it right away. It looked like I could finish it probably in a few months' time. So I said, yes, I'm going to do this. I told him that, and he said, well, I'm going to do a few revisions, and I'll send you another version. So he sent it back, and instead of 18 pages, it was 52 pages. And so that is a much larger piece, and it ended up being an hour and 40 minutes of music. And it took me 2 years to finish.
And then our hope was that, you know, maybe it would do a small workshop production, and then the school wound up doing a full production on the main stage, which was just, you know, a great thrill for two young men in their 20s. And ever since then, the piece has sort of, it's had sort of waves of interest. We've had a couple university productions, but we've never had a full professional production. And we're just thrilled to be coming to Fort Worth for its professional premiere. And have really been trying to find sort of the right home for our work. And I think we really have found a right home.
Yeah, so. Definitely have.
What does that mean when you talk about finding the right home? Because, I mean, it would seem that obviously you want a company that is professional, that has a good reputation. But is there more to it? Is there some sort of, is there a chemistry thing that you're also looking for?
Yeah, I would
I
say
think there is, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of like dating a little bit. You know, you do have to find somebody who thinks this, talking about the same thing that you're talking about. And I know one of the things that's very important to us is sort of finding a home that's very community-based. And certainly the community at Fort Worth, we're discovering in our past trips here, is very committed to the opera and very committed to the company. And so from that sense, it's very exciting to come and sort of share the work with them. And Fort Worth, under Darren Woods' leadership, is really sort of becoming known for their commitment to new opera. And it's helpful. It's so hard to get a new opera launched. So to be working with somebody who's very skilled at that and sort of, you know, really making that a mission of their company has just made our jobs much easier.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you want the piece to resonate with the community that you're where you're presenting it, And I think Fort Worth has its priorities in all the right places. You need to do the standard repertoire. I mean, those are benchmark pieces. Those we measure everything against that. Everything else we write, we measure against the benchmarks, and you have to present those. But the new works really energize everything else that a company does. They bring energy to the older pieces too, and they move the art form forward. So I think this opera company is really well positioned and is on a terrific trajectory, I think, and we're so happy to be a part of that.
And right. The other thing, too, I forgot to mention is we've been looking for a home. It was very important to us to find a place that was connected to the Hispanic community, obviously, given the subject mm-hmm. of the opera. So it's, you know, really exciting to be here with a company that's connected to the Hispanic community. And it adds a dimension to the work, which is it's hard to describe. It's kind of intangible, but there is something that it just adds an interesting texture to it as well.
Well, let's talk about that subject. Tell us about Sor Juana and how you first learned about her. And she's not well known in the United States necessarily, but she's still quite well known and looked upon with great respect in Mexico.
Yes, she's a hero there. And I think she deserves to be here too. And that's why we're so excited that we're doing it here in Fort Worth. In the States. But Peter came across her first. I didn't know about Sor Juana until he introduced me to her.
And I only found out about her. I had a friend who was a monk, and he had sent me a book about her. And when I first tried to make my way in the book, it's the sort of the Bible of Sor Juana studies by Octavio Paz, mm-hmm. which is a very difficult, dense book. And I really couldn't get through it the first time I tried to read it. But something about the story was incredibly compelling, and she herself was so compelling. And, of course, the poetry, which is the most important thing, is really quite beautiful, and the images are very interesting. The breadth of topics, the number of voices that she uses seem to have an extra kind of energy about them that was very appealing. So when I was in school and Roger had said, you know, have you thought about any other opera subjects? She just popped in my head. I was like, well, here's a good story. And as it turned out, you know, she's the perfect match for opera, I think.
Well, tell us a little bit about her life. She was not born into great wealth or prestige, right? And she found her way to the court.
Right. Yeah, she had no father. Her father abandoned the family. And for a girl at that time, there's very little that one can do. One either marries or one goes into the convent. And she had a passion for her writing and felt that the convent was going to be a place where she could continue to work. And, you know, she goes to the court first and has a wonderfully supportive family there, especially the vicereine, the royal couple in Mexico then. But she reaches marriage age, and there's a decision about what to do. And she and the vicereine together decide, well, you know, if you want to continue your work, probably the convent is the place where you can do that. Marriage probably will not afford those opportunities.
And one of the things that's sort of so fascinating about her in that regard is that she's pretty much self-invented. There is not a sense of, you know, she really chose what she wanted to do sort of every step of the way. And there's all kinds of legends about her as a child that, you know, for instance, when she was three, she snuck along with her sister who was getting learning how to read from a woman in the village. And the young Juana apparently went with the sister and said, oh, you know, my mother sent me here as well, even though that wasn't true. And same thing, she's taught herself Latin when she was 10. I think she had 20 lessons, I think is the correct number. So there's this incredible will and passion for learning. And one of the legends about her was that she wanted to disguise herself as a boy when she was, I think, 10 or 12, so she could study at the University in Mexico. which didn't happen. But she was very fortunate in finding her way at the royal court that the patrons, her royal patrons, were able to recognize her gifts and her genius and sort of give her the opportunity to develop. And the convent choice is a very interesting thing because it's, and this came as a revelation to me just in during research about her, is that it's not sort of what we would think of as a convent is today. So in many ways, one didn't have to have a profound religious calling to be a nun. It actually was sort of, for some women, a safety option if you weren't married. You know, you couldn't live on your own as a single woman in colonial culture.
Was it like living at Vassar College for the rest of your life?
Well, it's something like that. I think, you know, you had to pay a dowry to get in. But for instance, her room, you know, use the room word room loosely. Apparently she had a two-story structure with her own kitchen.
An apartment, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A servant. Mm-hmm. And the order that she was in was sort of known for being a little more relaxed. Now, relaxed is, a loose term.
17th century Catholic Church is 17th century
Catholic Church. Yeah, right, you can't get around that. But
it's not relaxed later.
Because she had actually entered an order earlier, which she left after 3 months because it was too severe. Mm-hmm. But running through all of that is a sort of a very clear determination not to be married. And she knew sort of above all that marriage would be the end of education and the end of writing. And in her self-defense that she wrote sort of at her life, she comes back to the point several times, which I find very interesting, that it must have been the pressure to be married as an option must have been, you know, even more intense than we can imagine. But she insisted that that was not the path for her.
Well, I know she didn't lack for suitors. And, you know, you look at portraits of people that were painted in their day and you can say they're very beautiful, but it's always like sort of through the lens of the style of beauty at that time. I looked at this painting and I thought she would absolutely be on the cover of a magazine today. She was very beautiful.
Yeah, yes.
Was there a sense that she felt burdened by that sort of physical ability to charm people when really what she wanted was to focus her life on her studies?
Well, it's a very complicated point because there's so much of the record is missing. Mm-hmm. So in reading about her, people suppose that there must have been some sort of heartbreak or some affairs while she was at the royal court, which of course seems very likely. She was single, beautiful woman.
But she, at the same time, she's so much smarter than everyone
right.
else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that she just, maybe these suitors were unsuitable because of their intellectual
right.
capabilities.
Dan had a very interesting insight about her, which we were discussing recently, which is and it's an interesting way to think about her, is that she was always the smartest person in the room. And
gets lonely.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. sort of the obvious thought after that was that must have been a very isolating experience for her at the same time. But if you read her love poems or the poems that she wrote in celebration of her patrons, they're incredibly sensual and physical and about desire and a wide variety of experiences of love. So it's one of the mysteries about her.
We're speaking this hour with librettist Peter M. Krask and composer Daniel Crozier. They are the creative team behind With Blood, With Ink, which will have its professional main stage premiere as part of the Fort Worth Opera's Opera Unbound series next spring. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
I was 3 and wrote poetry.
That is a little bit of With Blood, With Ink, the opera that will have its main stage premiere as part of the Fort Worth Opera's Opera Unbound series this coming April. With us today in studio are composer Dan Crozier and librettist Peter M. Krask. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That was Sor Juana speaking there, obviously describing her life. Tell us about the scene that comes from.
This is the first scene in the opera, and we see Juana on her deathbed, actually. She's been taking care of nuns suffering with some kind of contagious disease, plague or something, and she succumbed to it herself. And she has a moment of lucidity, and she sings this aria where she really recounts her life. And
then the rest of the opera unfolds from there, where she has sort of a dream of her past life and sort of how she arrived at the point that she did. And it's sort of the dramatic question for her at the end is sort of reconciling herself to her fate, you know, that she had this brilliant career, which she then was forced to renounce. And was that worth it? So that's sort of the journey of the opera.
And I know that at least in some of the productions that have been done so far, there are two different women playing Sor Juana. Is that the case here, or will that be the case here?
Yeah, there's the way the opera is set up is that the dying Juana is on stage the entire time, and she sees her younger self living her life. And the characters are unable to meet, and then sort of the climax of the piece is when the two Juanas finally do meet up, and she's able to sort of put her memory to rest. And it's sort of an interesting musical task, which I think Dan can say some more about, of having two voices for one person.
Right. They use the same musical materials, a lot of which are introduced in that aria we just heard, and come back at various places. But the two characters are very different. One has the perspective of a lifetime. The other is living the events at the same time. So the same character, but different.
Is there a particular way to write for these performers so that two different individuals will sound more alike than they might otherwise?
Well, when they sing the same musical ideas, it helps for that to be the case.
Yeah.
Now, we do have different voice types. The younger Juana is a higher soprano, usually, than the dying Juana. Both are sopranos, but one has a little more brilliance in the sound, I guess. But they sing the same music, and the one experiencing, I guess there's a little more edge maybe in what happens to her. The other is remembering, and memory gives us a different kind of perspective, and we hear that in her music, I think.
And memory is a sort of key feature of much of her poetry, that even her love poetry, it's usually not set in the present moment. It's usually some sort of looking back at a lover who's left or a person who has died. And her experience of desire is sort of in absence. Absence is a very important theme. So it seemed useful in putting the piece together of finding a way to use that poetic idea. So to sort of see visions of her past life. You know, if I think we've all had that experience as human beings of, you know, remembering things and wondering like, oh, well, what if I had made this decision instead? Or what if my, you know, had chosen a different path and being unable to do that? And so I think that's a very interesting dramatic idea and a very powerful one. And I think Dan's, one of the things he does really well as a musical dramatist is sort of keeping those strands very clear. Mm-hmm. So you're very clear of which world we're in at which time as well. So.
Yeah, the memory music, I think, is colored differently than music in the present. I tried to do that with harmony and with orchestration and the way the ideas are treated.
How much of the work on what is now the finished piece was done together with you two in the same room, and how much of it was, you know, a brief meeting and then both of you sort of went off to your respective studios?
Well, Peter worked first on the libretto, and it was essentially done when I got it after the revision, when I got the 52-page version. And I would work on a scene, and then we would meet in a practice room at Peabody, and I would play over it. And those were always exciting and a little bit scary moments for me because I hoped he would like what I had done with his words. And
they were, you know, the same thing for me too, that because you always want to hope that the words would provoke interesting, you know, musical ideas. And I think we've had a very unusual experience, I think, yet generally you hear about collaborations going awry or that they're very tempestuous or there's a lot of drama behind the scenes. And this has actually been, we had a very happy, easy experience. I mean, as, you know, far as devoting 2 years to writing a piece can be, but it's been a pretty smooth, happy.
Yeah, I don't think I asked for one word to be changed, and that's not always the way it is. I think I repeated one line of text at one point, and you noticed it right away when I did that.
Yeah, Dan's a very meticulous composer, so it's a real pleasure to sort of give him words because I know he treats them with great care.
Well, there's a rhythm to certainly written speech, but spoken speech, there's a cadence that gets in your head. And the way that words are used in opera doesn't necessarily reflect the sort of natural patterns of speech. So can you both talk about how these two things come together to create something that maybe is very different from music on its own or text on its own?
Dan, you want to go
first? Well, the first thing to remember as a composer setting text is that it takes much longer to sing something than it does to speak it.
Mm-hmm.
So one mistake very often that librettists make when they're starting out is to have many, many, too many words. But what I try to do is make things comprehensible. I like the audience to be able to understand the words. Now, once they've heard something a number of times, we can use that. Schumann talked about when he would find a poem to set, he would take it like an orange and squeeze the juice out of it to get the song, right? It was a tool for him. Now, once the audience understands the words and we repeat them enough, then you can be more free with the treatment. But I like it to be comprehensible. Now, so the opera ranges from what we would think of as recitative, sort of spoken, to more lyrical arias or ensembles. Now, obviously, when you have a lot of people singing together, you can't understand all the words. But Peter was thoughtful in setting up the libretto so that many times things that are sung together in big groups of people are presented first alone. So we get that text. Then it gets intensified. One of the wonderful things about opera is the fact that it gets to intensify language so much. Music has that ability, right? When we sing something, hear me with your eyes when distant ears cannot attend, a line from the libretto. Well, to say that, it means a great deal. But if we can add music, oh my, the depth it can take on, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, you know, interesting parts of working in opera as a dramatic medium because it is a dramatic medium. I mean, there's an idea, an old idea of sort of, you know, that you were just going just for the music. And obviously the music is essential because it's opera, but it is theater as well. And it's pitched at a sort of more intense level of experience, which I think is one of the reasons people who like opera really like opera. You're at a higher pitch. Everything's just taken up a notch or two.
Yeah, it crystallizes human experience in a kind of a more intense way.
Mm-hmm. And when it works right, I think, you know, the combination of words and music together become something else. It's kind of a catalytic medium that they both carry extra weight. And in a funny way, it's, you know, as silly as it can be to have people running around stage singing, which nobody does in life, and this is not an original idea to me, but they're... In one sense, opera is very realistic because you can have ensembles. So we have a trio or a quartet and people talking simultaneously or thinking simultaneously. And I think that's a very realistic idea because even in this room, we are all thinking simultaneously. We just don't have access to each other's thoughts. And that's one of the nice things that you can do in opera is sort of remove that veil a little bit and sort of have everybody present at one time. And since time and simultaneity is a very important question in the opera, it seemed like, again, a perfect match of story and form.
And maybe the right medium to tell this story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Paul in Louisville. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Interesting conversation. Interesting to me because I participated with a new opera some years ago, and one of the issues that we had to constantly face was, how do you convince the opera-going public, which is a specific type of an audience with a specific taste for in their music, how do you persuade that new audience that this is a piece worth listening to? Because sometimes I think the people who have who like the opera have already made up their minds that the great pieces have already been written. So.
That's an interesting question.
It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, it is.
I have a thought about that. I think one of the things that's might be draw people to coming to with Blood with Ink is that it uses operatic structures. It uses operatic devices, and Dan can talk a little bit more about this, but it uses a vocabulary that people know already and understand. And, you know, if you see The Marriage of Figaro, there is, you know, the famous sextet where six people are singing simultaneously. When you see with Blood with Ink, there's, you know, quartets, there's trios, there's duets. So there's gestures and forms that are unique to opera that Dan uses. And at the same time, I like to think it might be of interest to people that we've, while using that language, are introducing subject matter that's actually very contemporary and relevant. And sort of, I like to think the piece is a little sneaky in some respects, that one of the things that's fascinating to me about Sor Juana as a heroine is that she's intelligent. And
are they not usually?
Well, you know, I don't want to get myself in trouble here, but Tosca is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. She's many wonderful things. She's mm-hmm. passionate. She's loving. She's spontaneous, but she's kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to really get myself in trouble. Madame Butterfly is really dumb. Not a dumb piece, but as a heroine, she's not, you know, not too smart. And we've found in working with singers on the piece, the women themselves seemed very excited to play a woman who is smart. I think Dan can say some more.
Well, I tried to make the piece user-friendly in the sense that it's constructed in 9 scenes, and every scene has at least one big, what I would call a set piece, an aria, an ensemble, and some of them have more. The longer scenes have more. And it's constructed along the lines of little fragments of melody that are memorable enough that they stay with you, I think. You know, audiences go to opera to have a cathartic experience. The best pieces do that for them. And I think it's our responsibility as creators of new opera to make that happen for them, whether it's in, you know, new or old ways. I hope we can deliver that.
And I would add, too, I think one of the things that sort of keeps us in the continuum of opera as well is that one of the great themes of opera historically has been the destruction of something beautiful. Of sort of most of the pieces that we know, opera is tend to be thought of as a tragic medium. And certainly, you know, and unfortunately in this case, this is a story about the destruction of something very beautiful. And I think that's a way in for people who are opera goers and sort of want to expand their reach a little bit.
Yeah, there are certain archetypes, I guess,
yeah,
in the operatic literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this conforms to one of them,
yeah,
certainly, even though it's about relevant contemporary ideas.
Yeah.
For anyone who loves the idea of you know, an art experience that is, you know, heightened in terms of its emotional impact, the title alone sort of makes you think you're going to want to see this. It's very tantalizing. Can you talk about where With Blood, With Ink came from?
Sure, Dan.
It's from one of Sor Juana's own poems, a poem to St. Catherine. With her blood, if not with ink, she wrote the lesson of her life. And that's exactly what this piece is about, what Sor Juana's life is about.
And it also has a very literal true meaning is that when Sor Juana renounced her life's work, when she was forced by the Inquisition, she signed the oath in her own blood, which still exists. Apparently, it's in a library in Mexico that the signature is there with the blood stain. So, I mean, it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck just thinking about it. But
how public was her work? Like, how did she run afoul of the Spanish Inquisition if she was not cloistered but sort of minding her own business in her convent?
Well, that's it's a really extraordinary thing about her career. Dan and I were just talking about this morning. To me, in one sense, the surprise is not that the Inquisition shut her down. The surprise is that she had a career for as long a period as she did. Some of that comes from the fact that she was very politically adroit. She had royal patrons at the court who were always able to sort of get the Inquisition off her back. But even that said, there were times, for instance, where her mother superior, just for appearance's sake, forbade her from reading for a period of 4 months. But she never worked in secret. Her books were published. She wrote poems for religious celebrations. She wrote poetry for her patrons. So she was very out there. And it was just a question of when was the right opportunity to shut her down.
We're speaking this hour with the creative team of the opera With Blood, With Ink, composer Dan Crozier and librettist Peter M. Krask. We will talk more about this. It will be a part of the Fort Worth Opera's Opera Unbound series in April, and there are a series of discussions that we will tell you about in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation right now, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
Another selection from the opera With Blood, With Ink. We are speaking this hour with its creative team, Daniel Crozier and Peter M. Krask. They'll appear tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas and then tomorrow at the Modern Art Museum in Fort Worth for discussions about With Blood, With Ink, moderated by KERA's Jerome Weeks. The opera itself premieres at the 2014 Fort Worth Opera Festival in April. You can find more information at kera.org/think. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I know people are excited about these conversations that you're going to be having tonight and tomorrow. What else are you doing while you're in town? And are there things that you want to sort of have established before the cast comes together and the conductor is bringing the musicians together, that sort of thing?
Well, we've had meetings already with the director, mm-hmm. and we're really impressed by what she's going to do. And we've met all the creative team here and are so excited about the cast that's been assembled for the production.
Yeah, we're very particularly excited. Apparently, our star, Vanessa Becerra, is making her professional debut in the role of young Juana, and she is a native Fort Worth girl.
Wow.
And she's going to be singing tomorrow night at the Modern Art Museum. So that adds an extra layer of excitement for us.
Yeah, I just cannot wait to hear how she handles some of the music. So
yeah. I think, too, it's important with new opera, people approach the creative team often as we're the ones with the answers. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know that we have a whole lot of answers. We have a lot of ideas about what the piece is, and it's unusual since Dan and I have been living with this piece for almost 20 years, you know, we've had a lot of time to think about what it is. But part of the thrill for us is turning it over to a wonderful group of professional artists to see what they find in the piece. And we actually end up learning a great deal about the opera from them as well. So it's really a collaborative medium, and the energy goes in both directions.
It really does. Yeah. We're going to have a ballet troupe this time participating. The Ballet Folklorico will be participating, which is a new element for us and we're excited about.
Yeah, we didn't realize that there was an opportunity for dance in the opera, and there's a significant musical interlude towards the end of the piece, and our director, Donna Vaughn, had the great idea of incorporating this local Mexican dance troupe, and I think that'll be really wonderful.
Is there, like, when you go to see a full-scale finished production, is there an ideal place that you like to sit the first time you watch it from start to finish? Do you want to be in the front row? Do you want to be way in the back? Do you want to be someplace that nobody can see you?
I want to sit someplace where nobody can watch me cry, because this is, I'm a big crybaby, and there's two moments in the piece in particular that just every time I see it, I'm completely undone. So I always want to sort of keep out of view because I'm a mess. I think it unnerves the performers a little bit too, so I have to be careful about that.
Well, I like to hide, I guess, but I want to be in a place where I can be seen, where I can hear very well. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to hear
and
the
also,
best I can.
And know. Also to be able to watch the audience too, because it's...
Well, yeah, there is that.
You know, you want to see people engaged and you want to see them responding to the work. And it's such a privilege for us to introduce people to Sorbuana who may not know about her. And I think it's really gratifying to be part of the audience and watch them get pulled into her story.
How much of what she actually wrote still remains?
There's a sizable amount. Unfortunately, the big loss, big historical loss, is that all of her correspondence is missing, which would have been just remarkable to have some of. But because she was published, the books exist. And there's a pretty, you know, large edition of her poetry. The one problem is that nobody can actually date when she wrote the poems. It seems that she just came out a master of poetic form. You can't really chart a developmental line through the work, which is really amazing.
Well, she was a prodigy, quite a remarkable one. And the story about her being examined by all the intellectuals, the 40 intellectuals, is not apocryphal. That apparently happened.
Yeah, apparently when she was at the royal court, I think she was like 13 or 14. And you know, there's a bit of hagiography here that I think they're trying to draw a parallel to the Christ story of Jesus talking to the Pharisees. But apparently this did actually happen, that the court brought in sort of all the learned men of the day to quiz her because nobody believed that a young girl could know as much as she did. And she managed to triumph over all of them.
What role did she play in being an advocate for women's rights beyond the fact that she herself simply chose a path that was not expected of her?
Well, we can all read it ourselves, actually. There's a very important, there's two documents, but there's one, it's called the Response to Sor Filotea, which was a letter she wrote sort of defending herself. And within that, she advocates strongly for the right of women to be self-determining. And the excerpt that we played coming into it, you know, she says, "I have this nature. If it is evil, I'm its product. With it I was born, with it I will die." That's actually from the document. I've changed the language a little bit, but there are several other documents where she says, you know, how can it, God gave me a brain, how can it be a sin for me to use it? And I think that's still a very relevant question.
Right, yeah. Does he not want women to be fully formed, to be educated as men are? And I think there were some that started to see her point. Even in the church, she had a few quiet supporters, I think, who eventually recede into the background.
Right. And there are also several poems where She often wrote some sort of very stinging satires, and there's a couple where she takes men to task for their presumption and their fear of women. She often addresses it in terms of men being afraid of women. And they tend to be the funnier poems, but there's a little sting at the end about that.
Yeah. But a lot of her work is available in various translations, good English translations. Yeah.
So you both obviously have such great respect for one another's talents. I wonder, having worked together so closely, like what about what each of you does have you come to understand and gain some insight on? And are there things about each other's specialization that still sort of mystify you both, if the question makes sense?
Yes to all of the above.
Yeah. I am not a writer, and I'm so grateful to be working with one so wonderful as Peter. I cannot imagine writing my own libretto. Some composers do. I'll not be one of those.
Yeah. And I, the more, you know, we keep coming back to the piece and it's sort of, you know, put it aside for a couple years, come back to it, I'm continually struck anew by Dan's skill as a musical dramatist. One of the hardest things to do in writing for the stage is pacing events. Sometimes things move too slowly, sometimes they're too fast, and one has to have an intuitive sense of how much time something needs to have happen on stage. And Dan is a real master at that dramatically. And from a selfish standpoint, just I love the way he's set my words. He's got a real gift for lyric imagination. People who love singing should come to the opera because there's some real opportunities to hear just beautiful singing. But at the same time, there's a little bit of an edge. And I'm always sort of surprised every time you come back to it to find sort of how much passion and sort of violence there is in the piece as well, because Dan's a fairly easygoing man. And
well, the psyche is complex, I think, and there needs to be a range of expression in order for there to be sufficient depth, you know, to make someone want to come back and hear it again, or to have more to find there. But, you know, I think as we work as composers and writers too, I'm sure, we're trying to find a way to express that range of the psyche, of emotion, of experience.
Right. And you want it, I mean, ultimately it needs to come off the stage to the audience, you know, and that's one of the hardest things in the world to do, to create a situation on paper that comes off the stage that the audience can respond to.
So that they're talking about it in the car on the way home and 3 days later, that sort of thing?
Ideally, yes. That would be, that's the goal.
Yeah. How do you, I mean, it's been 20 years you're having, I mean, it's been performed multiple times, but not, I guess, at this magnitude.
Never professionally.
Never professionally, okay. So do you dare to dream that other professional companies will be calling after this, or what is your fondest hope?
From your mouth to God's ears.
Sure, we would love that.
Mm-hmm. What does it take to allow a new work to gain traction and to be seen as sort of worthy of being done rather than, you know, Tosca or Carmen or whatever?
Oh, that's a question for the ages. I don't know if I have an answer. I wish we knew the answer.
I think a company has to, you know, there needs to be a company that takes the chance with it.
Right, mm-hmm. And advocates for it.
Advocates it.
You know, and that's the joy of coming to Fort Worth is that in addition to taking the chance in the first place, there is such strong advocacy. And it's been a real pleasure. We've been at the last two opera festivals and have been at the evenings of the Standard Rep and the evenings of new operas. And the audience for the new opera here is as committed and interested and open to the new work as they are to the Standard Rep. And that's a really unusual thing.
It is. It's more the way things used to be.
Yeah.
When audiences were more excited about the brand new piece.
Yeah.
If you made a Venn diagram, how much overlap is there between the people who are most excited about the new works and people who are really there for the traditional works?
Ooh, that's a really tricky question. I think someone at Fort Worth can probably answer that better than we can. But I generally looking at the audience here, and, you know, since we're here, the festival's fairly compact, mm-hmm. it seems like a lot of the same faces. So one is hopeful that...
I think it's very healthy when that there's a large overlap. And I tend to think there's more here than a lot of places. We saw lots of people come to every production, and they were on their feet after the new opera and the old operas, too.
Yeah.
Does it take a certain kind of self-discipline to decide that you are finished, that this work is complete, and that you will not amend it further? Or did it just seem obvious that it was perfect? And
I don't know if it's self-discipline or maybe a little lazy, but
well, also just deadlines. The performance is coming, there's not much more you can do. I was still orchestrating before the premiere, just a few weeks out, mm-hmm. yeah. and that's an unpleasant feeling. Yeah. But once I finished that, and I didn't do it in the order that the opera is heard. I was working on the orchestration, I think, of scene 3, before we needed to have that for rehearsal.
And the other part of that is that, we wrote the opera. We were, very young men at the time. We're not those people anymore.
Yeah.
And I think we would run a very great risk of destroying whatever was special about that work coming back to it now. If the mistakes that are in it are youthful mistakes, and I think... I would hope at this point, we're both a little more sophisticated in our craft and tools. But there's a sincerity and a directness in its first incarnation. We've also been lucky enough, too, that we've seen the piece on its feet enough times, that we know that it works and we know that audiences respond to it very strongly. And I, in that sense, I'm superstitious. I feel like, if it ain't broke, don't mess with it.
Yeah. Peter M. Krask is librettist, and Daniel Crozier is a composer of the opera With Blood, With Ink. They'll appear tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas and tomorrow at the Modern Art Museum in Fort Worth to discuss With Blood, With Ink with Jerome Weeks of KERA. The opera itself premieres at the 2014 Fort Worth Opera Festival in April. Find more information at kera.org/think. Gentlemen, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.